contained the emotional component that Lisa is bored. A character with a strong attitude generates more comedy. A joke is just a joke, but an emotion can be mined. Runner-up was number 4, where Homer is upset that his burger joint is shut down. Oh no, the rotating pie station! The outline pulled together quickly since Homer, checking off his list of activities, provided a built-in structure. In the room, pitches jump from scene to scene, but an outline requires that the writer figure out the transitions. The Fugu episode took place over 24 hours. Most sitcom stories work better in a compressed time, and we hadn't discussed a transition from the night where Homer gets poisoned to the next day. I tried this. Interior bedroom, night. Homer, adjusting alarm clock. Then I'll get up at 7 to make the most of my last day. Interior bedroom, 7 a.m. The alarm rings. Homer rolls over and turns it off without getting up. Interior bedroom, 11:30. Homer rolls over, opens his eyes, and sees the clock. Homer, 11:30! Interior living room, minutes later. Homer, Marge, why did you let me sleep so late? Marge, you looked so peaceful lying there. Homer, there'll be plenty of time for that. Another transition that required some thought was the moment after Marge discovers Homer isn't dead. The episode never explains why he survives the poison. I thought Homer could return to the restaurant the next day. Master Chef, ah, Mr. Simpson, so you live. Our blowfish is so weak it won't even kill a cat. I must get a new wholesaler. Anyway, you owe us $56.80. We have a policy of not charging customers who die from eating our sushi, but since you survived... A typical sitcom outline has 10 to 12 single-spaced pages. My Simpsons outline had 17, and that was after cutting funny lines like, "Tomorrow is the last day of the rest of my life." Finally, I needed to give the episode a title. As a Dr. Seuss fan, I went with One Fish, Two Fish, Blowfish, Bluefish. It stuck. Outline notes. A few days after I turned in my outline, I was back in the Simpsons office to get notes. Matt Groening and some additional writers, all male, joined the group, and we moved to a conference room next to Sam's office. The chairs were arranged in a circle. I sat to the left of Sam, and Matt sat directly across. Jim Brooks wasn't there, but he'd read the outline and given his notes to Sam. The session did not start well. Sam thought it took too long to get the family to the sushi restaurant. I drew a big line through my first 2 pages. One of the best rules of screenwriting is start late, end early. In real life, we ring doorbells and ask, "How are you?" In TV and movies, you can just jump to the scene of the crime. Thankfully, the notes slowed down on page 3. Details were added. In the outline, the master chef is unavailable to slice the fugu because he's making out with a woman in the back seat of a car. Someone suggested it should be Bart's teacher, Mrs. Krabappel. They had to spell her name out slowly for me. This exchange didn't make it into the script, but it still cracks me up. Master Chef, oh, Miss Krabappel, your hair smells so clean. Miss Krabappel, oh, Mr. Hirohito, can you really get me a futamaki roll? The notes session dragged on. At one point, I looked over and saw that Matt had decided to rest his eyes for a bit, arms crossed in front of his torso at the wrists. I glanced over at Sam. I didn't know it at the time, but there was tension between the two executive producers. Our eyes met, and Sam's took on a conspiratorial gleam. "Don't wake him," Sam mouthed. Tragically, Sam died in 2014. He was only 59. When he learned that his cancer was untreatable, he devoted himself to charitable work to save and protect animals. It's hard not to think about his choice in light of the theme of this episode. Sam did so much good in the time he had. In the last 2 pages of the outline, Homer gets out of jail and races home to make love to Marge. I thought it would be funny to have Homer grab Marge, lead her toward the bedroom, and then cut to the two lying in bed, staring at the ceiling.
It's understandable, Homer, especially when you consider all the stress you've been under, Marge says.
In my old copy of the outline, the word sweet is written over this dialogue. Sam instructed me not to play the scene for laughs. Someone suggested that maybe Marge could read a poem that she'd written for Homer as they lay in bed.
I loved that idea.
The next scene was Homer saying goodbye to his kids and then heading downstairs. When we got to the second-to-last scene where Marge finds Homer's slumped body, Sam peered at his notes.
Wait, Jim has an idea for here.
I transcribed the pitch exactly as Sam read it. Marge touches his chin.
His drool is warm.
He's alive! He's alive!
This is truly my favorite line in the entire episode. Hilarious and poignant, it's quintessential Jim Brooks. Sam rejected the scene I'd added to explain why the poisonous fugu hadn't killed Homer. He said nobody would question Homer's survival. It still kind of bugs me. I'd also added a tag that wrapped up all the story threads. Sam thought it worked well and approved it. Writer's draft. Armed with a very detailed outline, I strung a script together. There are always discoveries along the way. I added hang gliding to Homer's bucket list.
Oh, Homer, says Marge, that's too dangerous.
Maybe at the end of the day, he concedes.
I took Sam's tonal note to be sweeter. In addition to writing a poem for Marge, I put in three quick beats of Homer stopping by each of his kids' bedrooms for one last look.
Homer. Goodbye, Maggie. Stay as sweet as you are. Goodbye, Lisa. I know you'll make me proud. Goodbye, Bart. I like your sheets.
Table read draft. As a freelancer, I didn't take part in the next stage where the staff tables a script. This means going through page by page before the table read. Sometimes scripts are overhauled completely, and writers end up with a written-by credit on an episode they barely recognize. I was told that One Fish, Two Fish changed about the same amount as a script by a writer on staff. The changes made scenes punchier. Bart and Lisa singing Mockingbird became Bart and Lisa singing Shaft, one of the most memorable sequences in the episode. At first, the Fox censors wouldn't approve the song because of the lyric, "He's a bad mother, watch your mouth." The producers pushed back. Sam sent over a tape of Isaac Hayes performing Shaft on the Oscars, and the censors relented. Only one revision bumped me. At one point, Homer offers Bart three phrases that will help him get through life. The table script read, number one, cover for me. Number two, oh, good idea, boss. Number three, it was like that when I got here. Fans love that line, but I still prefer the original three pieces of advice. Number one, you'll end up with a bad job, but if you kiss up, you can take a day off every now and then. Number two, find a woman who loves you, think twice about having kids. Number three, don't eat blowfish. Production, or shooting, draft. George Takei was cast as Akira Kurosawa, the sushi waiter, and Larry King read the Bible passage, tacking on some sports picks at the end. Al and Mike shepherded the script through the production process. For animation, that includes recording the actors, approving animatics, preliminary sketches, and adjusting the script and animation at every step. One Fish ran long and needed trimming. Sometimes it makes sense to omit an entire scene rather than making smaller trims throughout, which can lead to choppiness. Sadly, Homer seeking solace from Reverend Lovejoy didn't make it to air. Produced episode. One Fish, Two Fish, Blowfish, Bluefish premiered on January 24th, 1991. I watched with my sister Claire and brother-in-law Rob and was delighted to see the finished product. The biggest surprise came at the very end. I was expecting the tag that wrapped up all of Homer's actions, but it was slashed for time.
Instead, Homer simply declares, "From now on, I will live life to the fullest."
This pronouncement is followed by a hard cut to Homer in his armchair, eating pork rinds while watching bowling on TV. There was no dialogue, just the sound of a bowling commentator and crunching pork rinds. The new last scene, concocted by Al and Mike, was a gut punch. Homer had stared death in the face and had learned absolutely nothing. In that moment, we all became Homer, staring at a cartoon character who's staring at bowling as our lives tick away. The quality and quantity of material generated by The Simpsons writers was astonishing. I could have written 3 different versions of the same story. And even if Homer learned no lessons from his experience, I learned one from mine. At Newhart, I'd been instructed to write joke, 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 joke. Working with Jim and Sam taught me there was another choice, to play a scene for real emotion. Here's a comparison of Marge's poem in my writer's draft and the dialogue that aired. Writer's draft.
The blackened clouds are forming. Soon the rain will fall. My dear one is departing, but first please heed this call. That always will I love you. Da-da, da-da, da-da. Sorry, I didn't have time to finish the couplet.
Aired poem.
The blackened clouds are forming. Soon the rain will fall. My dear one is departing, but first please heed this call. That always will I love you. My one, my love, my all. Sometimes sweet and sincere trumps snarky. I didn't understand that until I heard Julie Kavner's gravelly voice reading Marge's poem. When she got to the last line, I didn't laugh, but my eyes got misty. I suddenly cared deeply whether a cartoon character lived or died. And that's a far more complex and interesting response. With the permission of The Simpsons, here's the lost tag from One Fish, Two Fish, Blowfish, Bluefish. Interior, Simpson House, living room, that afternoon. Homer is on the couch, drinking a Duff and watching arm wrestling on TV. He looks very content. Marge approaches, carrying Maggie and several pink message slips. Marge, Homer, the phone's been ringing off the hook. The police moved your court date.
Homer, oh.
Marge, the towing company has your car.
Homer, Barney.
Marge, your father says he wants to fly kites with you.
Homer, oh, yeah.
Marge, and your boss wants to see you first thing in the morning.
Homer, oh, no.
Bart sticks his head in.
Bart, hey, Dad, Mr. Flanders says, and I quote, where the ding-dong doodly are the stakes?
Homer, through gritted teeth, it's still great to be alive.
The end. Chapter 7. Brush with Greatness. Working for Letterman. Top 10 Least Popular Summer Camps. 10. Camp Tick in beautiful Lyme, Connecticut. My first top 10 joke aired July 12, 1990. By June 1990, it was starting to feel like I belonged in Hollywood. I knew my way around the freeways, and I'd already had the obligatory threesome with Warren Beatty. Okay, that's an exaggeration. But I did have dinner with Warren and one other guy. Sadly, I can't confirm that Warren is a grade-A lover, but I can confirm that he's a grade-A wingman. I met political pollster Pat Cadell at a party where we had a nice talk, and he asked for my number using the oddest pickup line that I'd ever heard. Maybe we could have dinner some night. I'll bring Warren Beatty. Odd, but effective. We made a date for dinner at a dark restaurant in Brentwood. Pat arrived solo and explained that Warren was tied up in post-production on Dick Tracy. Ah, the old bait and switch. It was fine. I could always talk politics with Pat, who made his name helping Jimmy Carter become president. Pat and I were halfway through dinner when suddenly he walked into the party like he was walking onto a yacht. Warren Beatty, in the flesh, made his way toward our table and sat down. He apologized for being late and then did something that truly amazed me. Instead of launching into a monologue about his life, he started asking me questions about mine. He wanted to know all about Spy magazine. Were Kurt and Graydon good guys? He even asked follow-ups, which meant he was listening to my answers. No wonder women tumbled for him. The next day I called my mom. Guess who I had dinner with last night? I said, pausing for effect. Warren Beatty. Don't you sleep with him. My mother snapped in a tone I'd never heard before. Don't worry, Mom, I said. It's not going to happen. My reasoning was less moral and more realistic. He's currently dating Madonna, I added. Not much was going on in my personal life around this time. A long-distance relationship with a nice guy in New York City had cratered during my time at Newhart. I thought about moving back east to try and jumpstart the romance. Impulsively, I sent some more material to Steve O'Donnell, the head writer at Late Night with David Letterman. I even included a small Japanese toy in my envelope, employing the same trick as charities that give you a nickel to get you to open their letters. I didn't hear back, so I took a job on a new sitcom called Married People. Created by Robert Sternin and Prudence Frazier, the series centered on three couples, newlyweds, new parents, and grandparents, who lived on different floors of a townhouse. I was just settling in when, at the start of the second week, Steve O'Donnell called. He'd received my material and they had an opening. Could I come in and meet with Dave? I was in shock. Late Night was known for being a frat house. A Harvard Lampoon frat house, but still. At that point, Meryl Marco was the only woman who'd ever worked on the writing staff. Bitingly brilliant and inventive, Meryl served as head writer in the early years and is widely credited with co-creating the show. What's the difference between Johnny Carson and David Letterman? Meryl once joked. Me. Meryl and Dave were also a couple, but after 7 years and four Emmys, she walked away from both the job and the relationship. There'd been no female writer hired since. I called Gavin, excited that I had a shot at joining the late-night staff. He couldn't fathom why I'd even contemplate a leap from a primetime sitcom to a late-night talk show. Everyone wants to go the other way, Gavin said. I know, but I want to write for the funniest man on television. I took that Friday off from Married People and flew east. My first meeting was with Steve, whose office had papers piled on every surface and even spilling onto the floor. I'm not an organized person myself, so the mess put me at ease. Also, Steve is one of the most affable and quick-witted people on earth. I spoke fondly of his equally clever twin brother, Mark, who drew cartoons for Spy and wrote novels and plays, including the Tony Award-winning book for Hairspray. Steve walked me down the hall to Dave's office and handed me off to an assistant. That's when I realized I'd be meeting with Dave alone. I'd seen photos of Dave's office in magazines, so the first thing I did was look up to see the dangling pencils that he famously tossed into the acoustic tile ceiling. For the rest of the meeting, the pencils hovered above me like little swords of Damocles. Dave sat behind his desk, wearing sweats and clutching a football. I'd prepared some jokes, but my main task was to convey that I could fit in. I mentioned my sports writing background. We talked about favorite teams while Dave tossed the football into the air. When an employee walked in, he threw the ball at her without warning. She caught it. Before long, Dave signaled the interview was over. Thanks for stopping by, he said, standing up. The meeting seemed to go well. I hadn't startled Dave by making any sudden moves. Later that day, Gavin called. He sounded angry. Congratulations, you got the job. Now turn it down. I screamed with happiness. Gavin told me I was nuts. The job was a 75% pay cut for me and, by extension, for him. I told him that this was my dream job. He reminded me that I already had a job and a 2-year contract that my bosses might not let me break. I returned to L.A. and talked to the Married People showrunners. I told them that I had a chance to write for Letterman, and they gave me the reaction that my agent hadn't. "You have to take it," they both exclaimed. I moved back to my rental studio on 57th and 8th, walking distance from the late-night offices at 30 Rock. The night before my first day, I opened my closet to figure out what to wear. After trying on a dozen outfits, I decided to go with Levi's, a monochromatic shirt, and shiny patent leather Oxfords from Fiorucci. People say dress for the job you want. And since I wanted a job that guys had, I dressed like a guy. On the walk to work the next morning, I felt a combination of excitement and pride. Only later would I learn what journalist Alexandra Petri perfectly expressed in this tweet. Wish I could shake younger me and tell her, if you are the only girl in the room, it doesn't mean you're better. It means something is wrong. I now understand some of the factors that helped me slip through the gates. Studies show that men are promoted based on potential and women on experience. For most of the male writers, late night was their first TV job. I had already racked up credits on 5 TV series, including The Simpsons. I had proved myself to the point that late night was willing to take a chance on me. Second, I was a good culture fit, a popular and flawed hiring strategy that considers a candidate's background in addition to their skills. A good culture fit allows a new employee to slide into an existing team. It's also a great way to keep out the weirdos. The late-night writers' room was filled with college-educated, white, cisgendered men who liked sports and were always up for pizza. I rifled through my credentials. Harvard degree? Check. Hetero? Check. Sports fan? Check. Up for pizza? Check. Penis? Well, I'd had my share. There's no doubt that my privileged background and skin color helped me get the job. Years later, I worked on a short-lived sitcom with the stunningly talented Larry Wilmore. One day, Larry and I got into a friendly argument about who had it tougher in TV writers' rooms, women or African Americans. You can probably guess who took which side. Larry and I argued our cases to a stalemate. We did, however, agree on one thing. African-American women had it the hardest. Today, I would concede to Larry that at least at Letterman, it was preferable to be a white woman. The show ran from 1982 to 2015, and the writer's room never included a person of color. That first morning, I got to work early and settled into my office, which was located on the main hallway across from the copy room. A stack of papers was sitting on the desk. New York Times, Daily News, New York Post, the tools of a topical joke writer. Other writers started streaming past my door. Most waved and kept going. One stopped to introduce himself and chat about mutual friends. It all seemed friendly until just before he exited, when he made an offbeat prediction. "Before this is over," he said pointedly, "I will see a tampon fall out of your purse." I felt strangely shaken as he walked away. Over the years, when I've repeated this story, friends usually react confused. Why would he have said that? I had no idea. Until about 20 years later, when I was working on Lean In and learned about stereotype threat. It turns out that when members of a group are made aware of a negative stereotype, they are more likely to conform to that stereotype. For example, our culture perpetuates the myth that girls don't excel at math. So when asked to check off a box marked M or F, before a math test, girls perform worse. Simply reminding girls that they're girls creates anxiety, which disrupts cognitive processing. Our culture also perpetuates the myth that women aren't funny. Perhaps this explains why that male writer went out of his way to remind me of my gender that first day. If he were simply trying to shock, he could have said, "Before this is over, I will hear you fart." It's the same joke construction.
That is, in the future, some bodily function will embarrass you, but non-gender specific. I don't think he acted consciously, but by mentioning a tampon, he singled me out by what set me apart. In a more hospitable gesture, someone on the production staff stopped by my office to give me a welcome gift. An old-timey, pinstriped, late-night baseball shirt made of scratchy white wool flannel. The shirt had an 8 on the front and back, commemorating the 8th season. I tried it on and it fell to mid-thigh. Most show jackets and t-shirts billow on me. They always give me a small, but it's often a men's small. Dave also paused at my door to greet me. Actually, I caught a glimpse of the boss almost every day when he passed my office at about 10:50 a.m. Dave walked briskly, like a guy hurrying home in a rainstorm. In those days, Dave rarely set foot in the writer's room and preferred to hear pitches over the car phone on his drive home. The writers would generate ideas during the day, then we'd break for that night's taping. After the show, Dave would return to the office for a post-mortem. We'd wait until we saw him hustling past the writer's room, head fixed straight ahead to avoid any eye contact. About 7 minutes later, Steve would gather his papers and say, "Well, I guess I'll go call Dave." Even this minimal interaction was reduced when the show switched networks in 1993 and relocated to the Ed Sullivan Theater. In the new offices, Dave and the writers were no longer on the same floor. At first, a glass security door to the executive suite required a card swipe, but supposedly Dave kept forgetting his ID, so they switched to a thumbprint recognition system. At CBS, relations between the host and the writers grew even more strained. A former intern told me that Dave once dispatched him to hand back pitches for the top 10 list to the writers with the message, "Like this, only funny." Despite Dave's bullying tactics, everyone in the office was eager to please him. It was practically built into the job description, which boiled down to, "Make Dave happy." When you're working that hard to please one person, it starts to feel like infatuation, and the women and men who worked on the show routinely fell in love with the boss. Since retiring, Dave has grown a long white beard and looks like his home address is a deserted island. But back in the day, he made sneering sexy. Dave combined a Midwest aw shuckness with a New York City fuck you-ness, and the result was irresistible. Movie stars threw themselves at him. Julia Roberts and Drew Barrymore openly flirted with him on screen. Behind the scenes, a stunning Emmy Award-winning blonde actress once complained to a late-night producer, "Why won't Dave fuck me?" Dave was catnip to non-famous brainy women, too. A book editor friend pleaded with me to get her a date with my then boss. "He seems so miserable on the show," she told me, "but I think I could make him happy. We'd have fun." My friend's complete confidence that she could soothe Dave's anxieties led me to coin a proverb. A woman who thinks it would be fun to date David Letterman is a woman who knows nothing about show business. Show business attracts performers driven by the need for attention, the need for praise, the need for approval, the need. See the through line? The creative process is often wrapped up in bottomless anxiety, and when the world applauds the result, it lessens the anxiety. Briefly. Then the need returns and even intensifies. Dave's superpower was being able to cling to his neurotic insecurity in the face of staggering success. It made no sense to me. He was consistently funny and the best interviewer in late night. Yet his perception seemed to be that every joke tanked and every show was lame. One Friday, Dave finished taping what I thought was a fine and entertaining hour of television, a perfect kickoff to a weekend. A few minutes later, I heard Dave storming from the elevator to his office. "You know what I'm going to do?" he blared. "I'm going to go to Connecticut, shut all the doors and windows, and pump my house full of snot." Another time, Dave was so distressed that during the show's postmortem, he made a group of producers and staffers line up.
He stood at the head of the line and announced that he wanted each of them to take a swing at him. Nobody wanted to hit their boss, but apparently he insisted. He moved down the row, stopping in front of each staffer and encouraging them, "Harder! No, harder!" as they delivered uncertain punches to his shoulder. This story perfectly captures Dave's unique spin on the power dynamic. He's the bully who makes you punch him. Truth is often the best basis for comedy, so I embrace the Dave is a bully conceit for many of my sketches. In one viewer mail bit, I had Dave hold a magnifying glass over a tiny sunbather in the miniature New York City cityscape until the sunbather exploded in flames. Another letter asked, "How many pairs of glasses does Paul Schaefer own?" Dave answers that Paul actually wears a new pair of glasses every night. Dave tries to badger Paul into telling the audience why, but Paul is reluctant to explain. Dave tells Hal Gurney, the director, to roll some bogus explanatory videotape. We cut to a pre-taped segment of Paul exiting into a hallway where Dave is waiting, his jacket slung over his shoulder. "Well, well, well, look who we have here. If it isn't Paul Schaefer," Dave says menacingly. Dave proceeds to shake Paul down for money. Paul swears he doesn't have any, so Dave roughs him up, shoving Paul face first into a wall. When Paul turns around, his glasses are mangled. Dave looks on and laughs as Paul shakes his head and mutters, "Every day we seem to go through this." Although Dave played a convincing tormentor on TV, he was always nice to me. Sometimes, while racing to his office in the morning, he'd break his stride and pause outside my door. "Hey, how's it going? Do you need anything? Would you like some soup?" Once Dave dropped in to let me know that one of my top 10 pitches surprised him. I looked forward to the occasions when he stopped by until one day in the writer's room we landed on a timely idea. Some of the writers wanted Steve to pitch it to Dave immediately so we could run with the premise that night. Steve seemed reluctant. He preferred to wait and call Dave in his car. "Or," he said, "perhaps Nell could pitch it to Dave the next time he's in her office." I was mortified at being singled out. It was just an offhand comment, but I took it as an insinuation that I was forming a less than professional relationship with the boss. My response was to start shutting my door at 10:30 so that when Dave strode down the hall, there'd be no reason for him to pause. My hypersensitivity probably stemmed from my experience with Stafford. I had a deep distaste for colleagues blurring the line between personal and professional, and lines were being blurred like crazy at late night. To me, the office resembled Versailles. It was a culture of palace intrigue with whisper campaigns, shifting alliances, and sexual liaisons. Dave reigned supreme, enjoying the rights and privileges of the monarch. It was admirable of me to shut my office door to remove any appearance of impropriety. It was also incredibly stupid. I cut myself off from having direct access to the king. Like many, I tried to ignore the intrigue and focus on the work. That had its own frustrations. Writers would submit sketches by slipping them under Steve's door, which explained the papers I'd seen on the floor of his office. Months would go by without a reaction. I joined the show in July, and my first week there I wrote a script for an elaborate pre-taped trailer for a summer blockbuster, Late Night, the movie. The bit featured Dave as an action star being chased by fireballs down the halls of 30 Rock while tossing out his catchphrase, "Aw, man, would you look at this?" The trailer also starred Michael Douglas as Morty, Denzel Washington as bandleader Paul Schaefer, and Glenn Close as the lovely assistant Rose who betrayed them all. I never got any response, yes or no. Summer turned into fall, and an action movie trailer no longer made sense. I contributed in every way available. For immediate gratification, there was always the top 10 list. A bigger thrill was when Dave included jokes I wrote in his monologue. One gag started with Dave complaining that his mom was cleaning out the attic and had tossed a bunch of his things, even though there was
some valuable stuff in there.
The audience imagined Dave pining over his Golden Age comic books or baseball cards, and then he delivered the punchline.
I said, "Mom, Mom, did you have to throw out my collection of Krugerrands?"
Thursdays were my favorite because we tackled viewer mail. One week, a viewer noted that Dave seemed to have an extra air of giddiness about him. I created a new cologne for Dave to hawk. Uncork the bottle and release the giggly schoolgirl inside you. Dave Letterman's Giddiness. Available at all fine perfume counters. By Prince Machiavelli. A more elaborate sketch involved a pre-tape of Paul at the People's Choice Awards, winning in the category, The Celebrity You'd Least Like to Have Dinner With. I got to sit behind Paul in my only on-camera appearance for Late Night. In October, Steve let me know that the show was picking up my option for the next cycle. Unlike at Newhart, I hadn't been worried. The increased job security meant I could upgrade from the studio I'd been living in since my divorce. I found a one-bedroom rental in the back of an Art Deco building on Central Park West and signed a 2-year lease. That night, I couldn't sleep. The thought of spending more time at Late Night made me uncomfortable. I couldn't quite pinpoint the problem, but the show's creative process was wildly inefficient and the overall mood was unhappy. This wasn't just my perception. Years later, Dave greeted a new writer by saying, "This is a terrible job, but it will look good on your resume." I'd been so concerned about whether I would suit Late Night that I hadn't contemplated whether Late Night would suit me. Lots of talented people, male and female, managed to become longtime denizens of what one producer dubbed Crazy Town, but I just couldn't see me thriving there. Roughly 5 months after I got my dream job, I decided to quit. I only wish I'd come to this realization before I signed a new apartment lease. After I gave notice, I was summoned to Dave's office. "I hear you're moving on," Dave said. "Seems like you just got here, so I was wondering why." I considered pouring out my frustrations, but didn't see an upside. Only an idiot would complain to the owner of a donut shop that donuts are unhealthy. Also, Dave's office door was open, and his assistant, one of his rumored mistresses, was sitting within earshot. I figured any complaints I voiced would be repeated and used against me. "I just miss L.A.," I shrugged. "You're welcome back any time," Dave said. I glowed. Like everyone else, I wanted the approval of the king. And I don't even hold the record for that show's fastest quitting writer. Another writer got so frustrated that he left before his first cycle was up. Unlike me, he supposedly didn't hold back and told Dave off before he left. Later, he and Dave patched things up, and Louis C.K. returned to the show. The late-night culture fit me about as well as that too big, scratchy baseball shirt they handed me on day one. I once brought the shirt into a tailor to see if it could be hemmed. The tailor shook his head and informed me that the thick fabric did not lend itself to alteration. Now it hangs in my closet, a perfect metaphor. On my last day at Late Night, I wrote my final top 10 jokes and packed my entire office into a small box. There was just one last matter to bring everything full circle. As I was saying goodbye to some writers, a tampon fell out of my pocket. The writer who'd predicted this would happen on my first day was there to see it happen on my last. We looked at each other in amazement. Yep, he called it, and we laughed. Maybe because I was already out the door, I didn't feel embarrassed. There was no denying that I was a woman, and if anything, being a woman meant I had to work harder and be tougher. As the saying goes, Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did. Backwards and in heels, and while bleeding from her vagina 5 days each month. Samples from 2 submissions for top 10 lists. Top 10 ways you know you have a bad doctor. October 25th, 1990. He bets you $5 that it's 2 livers and 1 kidney. Combination diploma, cab driver's license. As he writes out prescriptions, he says, "One for you and one for me." He wears a rubber glove on his head. Oh, sorry. That's the way you know a bad comedian. When you mispronounce his name and he tells you it's a hard G in Mengele, he makes you do your own pelvic exam while he watches. When she giggles, she was a stewardess before she met her husband, Dean of Yale Medical School. He insists on holding the specimen cup. Top 10 Ways McDonald's is Getting Healthier. July 25th, 1990. Fresher salads, fewer snipers. Reducing radiation emitted by golden arches. Fired all lepers on staff. Less horse tallow in the beef tallow. Ended tie-in promotion with Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. Special sauce now used for original purpose of killing bugs. Customers instructed to remove cardboard from hot apple pie before eating. Employees encouraged to use Kleenex instead of hamburger buns. Chapter 8. The Meat Cute. Sometimes I go into my own little world. It's okay. They know me there. Joel Hodgson. Most romantic comedies begin with a meet cute. At a coffee shop, a man and woman both reach for a latte marked Alex, and their eyes meet. In a vet's waiting room, a dog barks at a cat, forcing the owners to break up the fight, and their eyes meet. Meet cutes are cheesy, but sometimes life imitates cheesy art. After quitting late night, I returned to L.A. for good. Gavin thought it might take a while to get back into sitcoms, but comedic genius Robin Schiff, who later scripted Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, galloped in like a knight in shining armor. Robin had read my Simpsons script and brought me on board for punch-up during the January 1991 shooting of Princesses, a pilot she co-wrote with Barry Kemp and Mark Gansell. 3 weeks of work turned into over 2 years after Barry offered me a co-producer job on the hit sitcom Coach, which he created solo and starred Craig T. Nelson as a beleaguered college football coach. The series followed Roseanne in the lineup and consistently finished in the top 10. Married People, the series I'd been working on before moving back east, lasted only 18 episodes. Unintentionally, my detour into late night had landed me on a more successful track. During my second year at Coach, my friend Pat Whitney invited me to a fun party. Now to me, a fun party is an oxymoron. I know many share my fear of social interaction, but the difference is when others say, "I'm terrible at parties," their friends respond, "What? No, you're great." When I say, "I'm terrible at parties," my friends respond, "So what TV shows are you watching these days?" I fail at fun. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't like small talk. I also don't like loud music that drowns out small talk. I worry about forgetting names or committing a faux pas. When I do, it fills me with regret for days. So I keep to myself at parties and eat a lot of chips, which also fills me with regret for days. Still, I really wanted to see Pat, and he really wanted to go to this party. So I tagged along. As soon as we entered the Hollywood Loft, I knew this gathering was well above my play grade. I recognized a bunch of cool, funny actors, including Janine Garofalo and our host, Mark Fite. Pat was instantly engaged while I stood off to the side, eating chips. After consuming a regretful amount, I went looking for something to drink. The tiny kitchen was empty. The fridge was filled with beer, and I rummaged around for a soda. I found one in back and was just about to close the door when, "Hey, do you see any beer in there?" A male voice drawled behind me. "It's pretty much all beer in here," I said. I moved aside and the guy maneuvered around me. He grabbed a beer, closed the fridge, turned around, and our eyes met. I felt a jolt. Oh my God, I was having a meet cute. It wasn't dramatic, like Sandra Bullock saving Peter Gallagher from being run over by a train and while you were sleeping. But on the bright side, the guy wasn't in a coma. We stood in the kitchen making small talk, which I suddenly didn't mind so much. His Midwest drawl sounded familiar, but I couldn't quite place him. "Hey, I'm Joel," he said, sticking out his hand. It clicked. I was talking to Joel Hodgson, the creator and star of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a hilarious Peabody Award-winning show. The premise of MST3K is two mad scientists kidnap a regular Joe in a red jumpsuit and send him into space where they force him to watch B-movies. To ease his loneliness, Joel builds a bunch of chatty robots from spare parts. The bulk of an episode featured Joel and two robots in silhouette watching bad movies while sliding in wisecracks. The result was an original, inexpensive show that had the highest joke-per-minute ratio on TV. I expected Joel to return quickly to the cool kids in the living room, but instead he lingered and sipped his beer. He said he'd recently moved from Minneapolis. I frantically searched my brain for any personal connection to the Midwest and chimed in that I was working on a TV series set in Minnesota. Lame. But Joel turned out to be a Coach fan. Before he returned to the party, we exchanged numbers. The next day, Joel called. Before noon. I already loved this guy for not making me sweat it out. We met for coffee at DuPar's later that day. We both lived in Studio City, and since geography is the greatest determinant of whether a friendship will last in Los Angeles, we sailed over our first hurdle. Spending time with Joel was light and easy. Although our backgrounds were very different, we had similar interests. We'd sit side by side on his couch, flipping through his sketchbooks and talking about ideas for shows and movies. We'd go to the Magic Castle, the members-only Academy of Magical Arts Club where Joel sometimes performed. I don't know what attracts me to magicians, but I admit it. I'm a mag hag. We'd go to the silent movie theater on Fairfax and then grab a late-night dinner at Cantor's Deli. Our evenings seemed date-like, but nothing was developing between us physically, not even a tingly brush of the hand while reaching into a tub of popcorn. Joel never mentioned a girlfriend, but a few times he did bring up an ex-girlfriend. I can't remember what he said because my brain was too busy shouting, "He's straight! He's straight!" I tried to play it cool. I didn't want to press the matter because maybe Joel wanted to take it slow. Finally, late one night after a comedy show, Joel drove me home. I was renting a little house at the end of a dead-end street, so he offered to walk me to my door. We climbed the stairs and then chatted on the doorstep as the tension built. Something was going to happen. Something physical. We both felt this was the moment. "Well, good night," Joel said. Then he thrust his hand out for me to shake. I was stunned. I didn't know what else to do, so I shook his hand. "Nice to meet you," I said. My limited cool deserted me. I started babbling about how I was hoping that this would be more than a friendship, but it didn't seem to be headed in that direction, and was that even a possibility? Because I really thought he was amazing. In a romantic comedy, this would have been Joel's cue to stop my babbling with a kiss. Instead, he said, "I need to talk to you about that." Nothing good ever follows those words. It's never, "I need to talk to you about that. Because I want to spend the rest of my life with you." That night was no exception. Joel explained that he was dating a British comedian actress, and for several reasons, they were keeping their relationship quiet. Given the long distance, he wasn't sure that things would work out, but they were both committed to trying. "I want you to meet her," he said. "I think you two would like each other a lot." I nodded. Since we'd already shaken hands, I offered a quick goodbye and slipped inside the house. It hurt to be rejected. I flashed back to my teenage self, sobbing to my best friend Lisa Setlin, but I really liked him. I also worried that my unabashed declaration of desire might ruin our friendship. Would spending time together now be awkward? I went to bed feeling alone and unhappy. The next morning, the phone rang, and I heard a familiar Midwestern lilt. "Hey, Nell, it's Joel." I was so happy to hear his voice. He asked if he could come by. I said, "Of course." A little later, Joel walked through my door and handed me a manila envelope. "Here," he said, "I made this for you." I opened the envelope and pulled out a piece of art. It said, "Nell is cool." My heart melted. The colors have bled over the past 25 years, but Joel's sweet and colorful gesture of friendship still hangs framed in my office. Joel asked if I wanted to grab some lunch. It was early, but sure. Joel was born in Wisconsin and still insists on eating lunch at noon like a dairy farmer. Within 12 hours of my feeling rejected, we were back to normal. I quickly converted my crush into a sisterly devotion and shifted my sights to a different kind of partnership. From the start, it seemed like Joel would be fun to collaborate with. We have similar senses of humor, but different skill sets. Joel's a visual thinker, as much an artist as a writer, and his years of performing magic and stand-up gave him an incredible sense of timing. In late 1991, Disney hired me to do a last-second punch-up for the Emilio Estevez classic, The Mighty Ducks. Yes, The Mighty Ducks was punched up. When Disney approached me about another job, I pulled Joel in. Our first collaboration was Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves, the third installment of the franchise. A first draft had been written by the supremely talented Carrie Kirkpatrick, but the studio wanted revisions and Carrie was already committed to a new project. Joel and I got the nod. Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves was perfectly suited to Joel's visual sense of humor and to my love of tiny, shrunken people. We bought Model Train HO scale figurines and placed them all over my living room furniture to generate ideas. I had two wicker chairs, and we realized that wicker could be climbed like a ladder. We used this device to get Wayne, played by Rick Moranis, his wife and their friends Patty and Gordon, to a windowsill where they find themselves knee-deep in dust. From our script. Interior, windowsill, day. They start kicking and playing in the dust. It's a winter wonderland as Gordon scoops up an armful and throws it at Patty. Patty. What is this stuff anyway? Wayne. Things decomposing. Skin, hair, bug parts. Patty shudders and quickly shakes the dust out of her hair. The wicker chair excursion made it into the movie, but the playing in the dust scene was nixed by the producer. He said the dust would have required extensive hair and makeup cleanup between takes. Directed by Dean Cundey, Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves was released direct-to-video in 1997 and became Disney's third highest-grossing movie of that year. After Honey, Joel and I were asked to do a pass on the live-action George of the Jungle. Our additions included the opening animated sequence and fighting to make the character Ape, an ape, talk. At first, the studio balked at the talking animal conceit, but Joel and I convinced them it was essential to fans of the cartoon. We wrote the first pass of Ape's dialogue, which Monty Python's John Cleese voiced to perfection. George of the Jungle became a massive hit, thanks in large part to the sparkling Leslie Mann in her first starring role. The writing credit on the movie went into arbitration, which meant a jury of Writers Guild members read each version of the script and determined who contributed what percentage of the material. First and last writers, Josh Olson and Audrey Wells, were awarded on-screen credit. Joel and I fell short. Next, Joel and I decided to write a movie on spec. He had an idea about garbage bags that come to life and smother people, which worked brilliantly as an allegory for how we're all drowning in our own packaging. Joel called the project The Bags, and we wrote it quickly. The tone tried to capture the heightened dialogue of the B-movies that Joel had lampooned on MST3K. In the climax, a 20-foot garbage bag designed by sculptor Klaus Oldenburg comes alive and terrorizes the town. We even gave Klaus a speaking part. Joel drew an awesome cover with the tagline, Trash doesn't care, and we sent the spec script to our agents. I was convinced there'd be a bidding war. It never sold. Much like Trash, Hollywood didn't care. Joel and I had better luck when we pursued writing an episode of Space Ghost Coast to Coast, an animated TBS talk show hosted by intergalactic crime fighter Space Ghost and his bandleader-slash-nemesis, Zorak. We pitched a story to the producers that parodied Amok Time, the Star Trek episode where Mr. Spock is drawn back to his home planet Vulcan to mate. In our version, Zorak, a praying mantis, also feels the urge to return to his home planet and mate. A complication arises when Zorak learns that after mating, a female praying mantis devours the male's head. "Afraid of commitment!" exclaims Space Ghost. The producers approved our plot and sent us off to write. It was the most insane script Joel and I ever wrote. And we wrote a movie that featured a huge, homicidal garbage bag designed by Klaus Oldenburg. Space Ghost producer Matt Hannigan had given us a Thursday deadline. On Wednesday evening, we stuffed our pages in a FedEx envelope and sent them to Atlanta. Things were a little rushed at the end, but we figured we'd make fixes after we got notes. We didn't hear anything from the producers on Thursday. We didn't hear anything from the producers on Friday. I started to worry. There are no insecurities like writers' insecurities. Monday came and still no phone call. On Tuesday, I was at Joel's house and, with his permission, I called to check in with Matt Harrigan. "Hey, Matt, I just wanted to make sure you got the script," I said, using that old ruse. "Yeah, we got it," Matt responded. "Good, so Joel and I were wondering when you'll be giving us notes." Dead silence on the other end. Oh, no, they must have hated the script. "Actually," said Matt, "we recorded it Friday afternoon. It's all done."
"What?"
"Yeah, and it read great. Thanks so much." I hung up the phone and turned to Joel. "We should quit right now," I said. "We will never have a better experience than this." Over the next few